Welcome to The World Next Week's special year-end episode, The World Next Year. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, it's hard to believe 2021 is coming to a close already, and we are in our late December mode of peering over the horizon for an entire new year. In this episode, we will discuss some of the leading foreign policy challenges heading into 2022, but also take stock of what happened around the world in 2021.
Joining us for this special episode of The World Next Week is Shannon O'Neill. Shannon is Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, and Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is an expert on Latin America, global trade, U.S.-Mexico relations, corruption, democracy, and immigration. I could go on, but I think I'll just stop right there.
Longtime listeners of the podcast might remember Shannon from last year's special year-end podcast. We enjoyed that conversation so much, we had to ask Shannon back, though again, we are doing so in our floating podcast remote studio. Shannon, it's always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks, Jim and Bob. It's great to be back with you both.
Shannon, let's kick off our discussion by talking about a topic in place you know well. I am thinking about democracy in elections in Latin America. 2021 was a big year for elections throughout Latin America. Ecuadorians, Nicaraguans, Peruvians, and Venezuelans all went to the polls this year. How fair some of those elections were, up in the air. In 2022, two big elections are on the calendar. Colombians will vote in separate congressional and presidential elections this spring. And then in October, Brazilians will elect a president, a vice president, and a Congress. But as you know, democracy is about more than just elections. In Latin America, as well as elsewhere in the world, one has to think about human rights, the rule of law, how free and fair those elections are. So can you break down for us, Shannon, what the state of democracy looks like in Latin America?
Sure. Well, it was a big year this year, and it's promising to be a big year next year and really defining the extent of democracy. And what you saw throughout this year, and I would expect for 2022 to come, is that incumbents had a pretty hard time of it. They, at least in all the democracies, you saw outsiders come in and win these various elections. This is somewhat new, I would say, in Latin America. In normal times, often the president, if they're running for re-election, or the president's party, has a real leg up. But as we've seen in Latin America, and frankly all around the world, is that these are not normal times. So if we look back just a little bit at these elections, we saw in Ecuador, we saw a surprising win by a businessman, so a sort of rightist party that came into a country that often leans to the left. In Peru, we saw an outsider leftists win, much to the shock of the political establishment, a quite fragile political establishment, but still a shock to the political establishment. So that is a new person, a new party that came into the politics there. I would add to your list Chile. Chile had its first round of elections just a couple weeks ago, and now it's having its second round coming up this coming Sunday. And there we are seeing two outsiders, one from the pretty progressive left and one from the far right, come and contest these elections. And, you know, the traditional parties, the traditional left, has really been weakened substantially in terms of their own candidates. And the traditional right, there were two political parties, and together, neither of them, or their combined votes, were less than an economist who was running for president from Alabama for the Chilean election. So really, those parties have disappeared. So overall, you see outsiders winning. The one exception is Nicaragua, where Daniel Ortega, who has been president, is president again. But to get to that position, he had to destroy the last vestiges of democracy in that country, throwing almost every one of his political opponents into jail before the elections were held. So that is a trend that we've seen pretty much throughout the region this year, and I would expect to continue into 22 as we look to the elections there. So in Colombia, we see right now the leading candidate is a leftist, Gustavo Petro, who was a former mayor of Bogota, who's a senator now. And this would be the first time that the left gains that highest office in really decades that we see that leadership if he succeeds. I think there's a good chance that the center or center right may come back, but for right now, he's leading in the polls. And then finally, we'll turn to Brazil. So October elections, and then probably a follow-up second round, depending on how the vote goes. And there it looks like President Jair Bolsonaro, who comes famously from the right, both on social issues, but also economic issues. He is trailing badly in the polls. And at least right now, it looks like the former president, Lula, who comes from the left, from the Workers' Party, may come back for yet another term in office there. So there's a lot of moving around of parts and really an anti-incumbent position across these countries.
Shannon, what do you think it is that is is driving this anti-incumbent bias or theme across the region?
So some things are pretty obvious. First and foremost is COVID. So Latin America has had a really rough ride through COVID. This is a region with less than 10% of the global population, and they've had roughly a third of all the deaths. You have seen healthcare systems just decimated and unable to deal with the virus. You have seen schools, education systems just collapse, and many Latin American children are not yet back in school already, almost 2 years in. You've seen other public services just really fall apart with this. So partly there's a frustration with the way these governments have dealt with or not dealt with COVID. You also see perennial issues and a frustration with democracies and democratic public management in general. So issues of inequality, issues of access to opportunity, issues of violence. These continue to be real challenges for Latin America, and many feel that democracy just isn't delivering. So the good news, I think, in Latin America is in most countries, citizens and voters are still using democracy and elections to express their grievances. But in expressing their grievances, they're looking for somebody who's not a traditional politician. And so that's why you're seeing anti-incumbents on the rise.
Shannon, another sort of phenomenon that I think has also hit Latin America is the rise of populism. In this hemisphere, I would say generally, in the country that we're in right now included, a great deal of angst over the way the so-called elites and the incumbents were dealing with affairs, whether even before COVID, but including now COVID and other issues. I'm wondering whether you are seeing a concern about this fear that we've seen happen with populists taking hold elsewhere in the world, where they get the reins of power and they don't want to give them up, and they in fact want to entrench their power and become illiberal in a soft term, or even worse. Are you seeing a concern that this is a serious threat in the region?
You know, that's a perennial concern in the region, and Latin America really is home to populists. They've had a century of populists in various countries, and famous ones like Juan Perón in Argentina and other Vargas in Brazil and other places. So they have dealt with the ups and downs and the weakening of institutions of these charismatic leaders that show up and promise the world, but also concentrate power in themselves and their closer coquetry. So this is something that they've struggled with for many a decade. You do see this in the region. In fact, you know, the biggest democratic failure, I would say, in Latin America today is Venezuela. It's not only a democratic failure, it's an economic catastrophe and causing a migration crisis from there, but throughout the region. You know, that is exactly an example of a populist who came to power and then undermined elections and other democratic institutions to now put power among a small group of kleptocrats. So it is a worry around the region. In fact, the one thing that you do see in elections as, you know, campaigns fight it out and try to push for advantage and to appeal to voters, often Venezuela is held up as a cautionary tale. And particularly the center-right or right candidates paint often their leftist opponents, but point to Venezuela is that is not where we want to go. So, you know, I think it is a real question. You have these democratic institutions, you have these institutions of state, of you know, ministries, health ministries, education ministries, social ministries, and the like, really suffering under the weight of COVID and the costs of COVID. So there's a challenge there in terms of the fragility of the way government works. But you do in Latin America, because you have this very vivid authoritarian populist government in Venezuela that provides a little bit of a cautionary tale that I think sometimes we don't see in other parts of the world. You don't see, it's not as upfront and personal as it is for particularly the countries of South America, for Colombia, Peru, Chile, and the others who have Venezuelans living amidst them precisely because of what populism has done to that country.
You know, you mentioned Venezuela. I would just mention one other thing about that. You mentioned the outflight of so many people. And then the other area we've written about and you follow closely, I know, is the Northern Triangle, the three countries in Central America, also outflight. One thing that those three countries have in common, Venezuela, is sort of the failed state aspect, real collapse in governance. And yet Honduras is getting a lot of attention now because maybe their elections have opened up a path where, you know, maybe they can start to put things together and with U.S. help. Is that an exaggeration to say, you know, Honduras holds a light out of the darkness?
You know, I think it's at least a candle that's lit. So it is a path there. And so we saw elections in Honduras just this last month. For the last decade plus, you have seen a more center-right party ruling the country, but not even just a center-right party, really a party that was a kleptocracy, one that was closely aligned with drug traffickers in the country. And in fact, the president who's stepping down has been indicted in a New York City court for his role as an accomplice in drug trafficking along with his brother. So you saw a political machine that was deeply embedded with criminal organizations throughout Honduras lose the election. And there was a real question in the lead up about whether violence against opposition, whether they would steal the vote and the like. And in the end, they did not. Either they did not or they could not. But now we're seeing a new political party come in, more on the left, but, you know, someone who's really reaching working across at least some elements of society and the Congress. So I think it is a first step. It's hard to fight back against a lot of those vested interests, some of them illicit, some licit. And so I think the new government will have a real challenge there to try to turn a nation around that has fallen quite far in terms of corruption and institutional fragility. But I do think they have the opportunity to be and to find a very willing partner in the United States. Because we see here in the United States, because of the migration issue over the last few years, a U.S. government, both in the executive branch, but especially also in the Congress, really wanting to provide resources and funds and programming to address, you know, what are called here the root causes of migration. And so there, I do think there's an opportunity to work with this new government coming in that was never possible with the previous government, given the illegal ties and the corruption and the drug trafficking ties that it had.
Shannon, could I draw you out on two countries we haven't mentioned in our conversation so far? That's because they haven't had elections. That's Cuba and Mexico. Now, in the case of Cuba, we saw what were described as the largest public protests in the history of the regime this past summer. It's not clear where those protests have gone to. And in the case of Mexico, we have a country that is clearly of great importance to the United States. It's also a country that's near and dear to your heart. You have written widely and well on Mexico. How is Mr. López Obrador doing as president of Mexico? There have been concerns aired that he might be taking Mexico in a decidedly populist, less free and open and democratic direction.
Well, starting with Cuba, you know, this is one of the countries that is not a democracy within the hemisphere. It's one that does not hold elections, or the elections they hold are considered all around sham elections. And so you are seeing people trying to find other ways of expressing their political positions, desires, opposition. And that's what really led to these protests. We've seen over the last year or two protests guided by song. A viral rap song that went all over Cuba, but all over the world, protesting some of the conditions in Cuba. And you've seen these efforts to go out and march and protest. They were really shut down by the Cuban government. They did not allow or brook this kind of opposition. And the leaders of these movements were actually kept in their houses during these efforts to rally people and bring them out to the streets. So what we see there is when there's a difference of opinion, Cuba has continued to go to this much more authoritarian place. And I think, you know, that will continue. They've been able, as a sidebar, they've been able to continue to do that in many ways because they continue to get oil and other resources from Venezuela. So even as Venezuela's economy has shrunk by almost 80% in terms of its GDP over the last 10, 15 years.
You just say 80%?
80%. Yeah, it's 20% of what it was back in the 2000s. It's
That's
unimaginable.
Stunning.
It's stunning. You can't even imagine what it would be like in your own, you know, in your own society to have 80% of your economy just disappear. But that is what's happened to this country. And 6 million of its people have disappeared. So 20-25% of its people have left the country as well. But this is a government in Venezuela that continues to send natural resources to Cuba and to keep that government up and running, or at least help it continue up and running. Switching to Mexico, you know, Mexico did have elections actually this last year. They had midterm elections last June. The president's party won a majority of those elections, but not a super majority. And so the president had been hoping that he and his political party and coalition would gain enough seats in the Congress to have a super majority allowing him to change the Constitution. And he did not achieve that. So it showed his strength, but also showed his limits. And Mexico, the president has a 1-year sixth term. So he's halfway through that. He's gotten through 3 years. He has a little less than 3 years to go. And what you usually see is a president's power begin to dissipate a bit as people look to the next election. So he has a couple candidates that are in the mix. Most people think that he favors the current governor of Mexico City. Used to be mayor, now it's called the governor of Mexico City, Claudia Sheinbaum, who is a close ally of his and longtime partner or political partner in terms of a patriot of his. There's others. The foreign minister also is running. There's a member of the Senate from Morena that also has put his hat in the ring, or at least implicitly put his hat in the ring. So we will see what happens in Mexico. But what we have seen as the president gets to the second half, as he's trying to give his coattails to the next person in his party to become president in 2024, when their election will be, is you've seen him start to erode some of the trappings of democracy. He goes after independent journalists and the press, particularly those that might be critical of the government. He has been going after scientists and academics and others who have independent views, in fact, trying to charge some of the most prominent and illustrious scientists with money laundering careers, trying to land them in the prison that would hold people like El Chapo and other drug traffickers. He has gone after or begin to criticize the National Electoral Institute, so that the body that runs elections. And he's also gone after after many of his political opponents. And so those who have risen in the polls and show sort of strength against his party members, some of them have been charged with corruption or charged with other things that, at least from the surface of the case, look very politically motivated, as the facts just don't line up with reality. So I do think this is something for the United States, for Mexico, of course, but for the United States, as we watch our neighbor and one of our biggest trading partners, one of the places with the, you know, largest back and forth in terms of people, in terms of goods, in terms of services, in terms of security, in terms of all kinds of things. It is a moment when Mexico really is on the brink of democratic erosion or weakening.
So obviously, Shannon, plenty of food for thought for how we should regard our own neighborhood, but also I think the rest of the world. A lot of the issues you brought up for Mexico and beyond in the region, I think apply to many other countries. So a big year again for democracy.
Yeah, well, Latin America is not the only place facing populism, as we all know, even right here at home in the United States. You know, one thing that I would say has been affecting all of these democracies and elections is the global pandemic. And particularly that's been a focus here with the Biden administration in 2021 in the United States. Bob, as we know, in the last few weeks, we've seen a new variant come aboard and come out into the world. This is the Omicron variant. And, you know, this is almost certainly not to be the last of the versions of COVID-19 that we will all be dealing with. Could you tell us a little bit more about that and how you see the spread of Omicron, other variants that might come, and really how should the United States and the world more broadly, how should we start thinking about COVID in 2022 and the years to come? What is the path that you see given the path where we've been?
Yeah, you know, there was a moment this year, Shannon, when I really thought this podcast would be talking about a post-pandemic world. That really seems to be premature. And I'll get to the what we know about Omicron at the moment. But first, I think it's worth summing up a little bit of 2021. It was really the year of the vaccine. And we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it was quite extraordinary what developed. Even with a virulent new strain, the Delta variant, which was highly infectious and really spread rapidly worldwide and certainly in the U.S., you had vaccines showing they could fight back. And that people thoroughly engaged were able to fight back. And if they got the infection, they were mildly ill, but you weren't seeing the devastating, you know, high rates of hospitalization, especially with the more vulnerable parts of the population. You had a rollout of the vaccines that was fairly effective in the U.S. and other developed countries early on. The U.S., and I'll get to that in a minute, you know, sort of hit the brakes, unfortunately, but you had, you know, elderly people, I think it are now at something like 87% vaccination rate. This is fully vaxxed. You had, again, the vaccine spreading in pockets throughout the world. But then you have the downside of 2021, which was, although there was a widespread information and urging from many healthcare professionals that these needed to be disseminated globally and swiftly, the countries that had the vaccines, the U.S. and many others, you know, slowed down. And when I talk about the vaccines, I'm talking about a half dozen or so developed in the West and in China. You had, you know, let's say the Western emphasis was on not only their own countries, but seemingly disproportionately, they were sharing vaccines in Asia. And parts of Latin America. China seemed to be focusing on countries that were part of the Belt and Road Initiative. But a continent like Africa was woefully underrepresented in terms of the vaccines it received. And still to this day, there are some countries in Africa with, you know, something like 4% of vaccination. You have across the continent strikingly low numbers of healthcare professionals who are fully vaxxed in Africa. And so this has raised all sorts of concerns about the ability of a variant to emerge. So the first reports of Omicron that you mentioned were from South African health officials, and it immediately got the attention of global health authorities, and the World Health Organization called it a variant of concern. It was a designation that I think had only been given to three previous variants out of trillions that have been logged since the coronavirus pandemic emerged. And Omicron, by many accounts, is much more transmissible than even the Delta variant. There is a lot that is yet to be known, and I would repeat that there is a lot that's yet to be known about how serious Omicron can be. There are some early indications that it is not as strong. It is not going to create the heavy illness that we saw in, say, Delta or previous COVID-19 strains. But if it is highly transmissible, it can still affect many more people, and especially those who are not vaccinated. We also don't know the extent to which vaccines really help. There seems to be a resistance that the boosters that have started to roll out, especially the Pfizer booster, that they can mitigate quite effectively Omicron variant. But we're going to hear a lot more. We're going to see it. We're starting to see reports now coming out from the UK and other countries where it has seemed to set in a bit more. And so we'll have to deal with that. And then on top of that has come the recriminations on vaccine policy. And I'll start with the U.S. because the U.S. numbers are so staggering and so disproportionate to the rest of the world. It is worth noting here. We've just marked, by many estimates, the 800,000th death under COVID in the United States. Some people think that figure is much higher. The daily death toll is still in the ballpark of 1,000 or so a day. I mean, sometime next year, we're going to hit 1 million deaths just in the U.S. There's 5 million or so globally. And you have a total full vaccination rate in the U.S. of about 61% and a really strong anti-vax movement. You have portions of the Republican Party that have made it a strong point of pride and of policy to push back against vaccine mandates, mask mandates, especially on the governor level. And parts of the country where you're not seeing vaccination are the parts of the country where you're seeing hospitalization rates surge and fatality rates surge. So it's a difficult political spot for the country to be in. But also, I think collectively, I would just add as a final note about Omicron, coming as it did, the news about it during the Thanksgiving holiday was a real body blow to a lot of people, because I think the fatigue is palpable. I think people are fed up across the board. And the whole notion of a new set of lockdowns, but also all the acrimony involved in public health policy over this has really created a bit of a pall over the country at the moment.
So can I ask on Omicron? So one thing that happened is South Africa found a new variant. It started popping up and they immediately informed the global community. And you have scientists around the world now working on this and on the, you know, the variant and the DNA of it all and working to see if they can adjust the vaccine or there's other palliatives and the like. So in some ways, have we learned anything over the last 18 months? We've seen much more cooperation, it seems, this time around than we did the first time around. But how do you see those interactions between countries? And maybe you could also just touch on vaccine diplomacy. How have we been doing so far?
It's a really good point, Shannon. I mean, I think it's a spotty record. Again, the emergence of the vaccines themselves and then the ability of them to be disseminated in any capacity was quite stunning, certainly for the first half of 2021. And then as the year moved on, the information was passed along about the need for boosters. And again, it's still an area that's more needs to be learned, but there seemed to be a good deal of data about the waning effectiveness of the initial around the vaccines. And so this is all countries sharing information. As you said, the South African officials were the tripwire for Omicron, and they came out really quickly and the world responded quickly. But it also is kind of underlines a fault area in the world, which is that you immediately had the recrimination starting that, oh, well, you know, the world overreacted. You had countries, and especially in the West, sort of create suddenly a travel ban that involved mostly African countries. And you had people within the U.S., you know, on the talk shows or in the political chambers saying this was ginned up by Democrats wanting to create new strictures and new limits on behavior and promoting masking and so forth. So you had that emerging, that sort of notion emerging. And then you have this ongoing international, this anomaly across the world of sort of how the world is supposed to travel again, how the world is supposed to do business again. I think the business side has in some ways been a model for problem solving in some ways, despite all of the well-known problems with global supply chains. You know, you had the business community take advantage of, you know, the virtual meetings and using technology to communicate better and to try to troubleshoot areas where, you know, supply chains were broken down. But in terms of just traveling, there's still no sort of standardized rules of the road, so to speak. The New York Times in the past week did a rundown of the different types of documents you might need to travel abroad. And there was at least six for sort of traveling to places where people wouldn't have thought twice about just having their passport and that was it. So proof of vaccination, usually required in many places, although not all. A completed locator form. The UK and some EU countries want to be able to have a digital passenger locator form before you enter the country. Coronavirus test results, maybe, you know, within 24 or 72 hours of when you arrive. And depending on how long your flight is, the math gets really kind of blurry. You know, mask mandates. Germany requires you to have an N95 mask to ride on public transport, for example. It's a kind of mask that many Americans would recoil from or not even familiar with. Many wear cloth ones or they have all sorts of gimmicky masks that they use almost as a political statement. And proof of insurance is another thing. Some places require you to have proof of health insurance in case you come down with COVID or anything else for that matter while you're traveling in their country. And on and on and on. And there's no sort of calibration across boundaries of what is a standard thing. Is there one standard form of like a vaccine card, for example? I guess I would answer your question by saying, you know, the world is talking, you know, across boundaries, Shannon, and solving a lot of the big problems, but there's a lot of the basic ones. And I think there's a real concern that that the vaccine nationalism that we saw can crop up in other ways if we're going to keep dealing with bouts of variants of different virulence.
Shannon, Bob mentioned supply chains. I think most Americans hadn't given a thought to supply chains in their entire lives. It became a term that was talked about a lot in the course of 2021. You, as always, are ahead of the curve. You have a book coming out in 2022 on supply chains from Yale University Press. Could you help us understand why COVID has so disrupted supply chains? And are we likely to see those disruptions resolved anytime soon? And will Santa be able to deliver presents at Christmas?
That's the big question, right?
Exactly. In that order. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, a lot of the reasons why supply chains have frozen up and you don't see the things you want in the supermarket and the like do have to do with COVID. So one of the reasons is a supply shock, as they would say. So as COVID has rolled out, people went home, factories closed, borders closed, as Bob was just saying, and it was just harder to get things made and then in and out of the country. And that has continued as Omicron and others go through. You still see things closing down, or you see health protocols and others just making it hard to move things around. So that's one side, sort of the supply side. The other side is the demand side. And unlike most recessions, Americans just kept buying. So they kept buying because the U.S. government stepped in and gave hundreds of billions of dollars in PPP loans and kept businesses open. They gave stimulus checks that went into people's bank accounts. We also saw, because restaurants closed and people didn't take vacations, the services where you usually would spend money, people weren't spending money on that. And so they spent it on goods. And in this last year, Americans have spent $1 trillion more on goods than they did in 2019 before the pandemic hit. So think about moving $1 trillion more of goods through supply chains that would be in the normal times, and these aren't normal times. So that demand surge has been really hard. So those are really COVID-based things. When we see restaurants open up and people go back to movie theaters and decide to take vacations, they'll start spending more on services rather than goods. As we see, you know, hopefully, you know, COVID restrictions, you know, lessen a bit and the movement of more planes flying, more ships sailing, we will see the supply side become easier. So a lot of this stuff is transitory. I know that word is, you know, used and people don't like it when the head of the Fed uses it and the like, but some of these have to do with the virus, which is still with us. So I think that's a big part of the supply chain aspect. There are some other aspects here that are actually longer term, and that's a bigger story and we can talk about another date, but that is the policy side of things. And what we have seen before COVID, but especially during COVID, is governments around the world are jumping in with all kinds of policies that they want to guide their economies. And those things are a lot stickier. And those things are going to last a lot longer. And I'd give you a quick example, just semiconductors. We talk a lot about semiconductors and how COVID messed up semiconductors, and there aren't semiconductors for your car or your phone or your washing machine or the other stuff that you want. And that's true that COVID has disrupted those supply chains. But in 2018, the Trump administration put tariffs on semiconductors, and then they put export controls on semiconductors and also machinery that makes semiconductors to China. And so semiconductor supply chains were already discombobulated and in disarray because you couldn't get semiconductors to China, where a lot of stuff was made that were coming from the United States. And China's expectations for how many semiconductors they were going to make fell very quickly because they didn't have machinery anymore to make the ones in the future. So you already saw changes happening then that made it really difficult once COVID hit. And we're going to see more of this because many countries, the United States, Europe, Israel, Japan, South Korea, China, they're all jumping into the semiconductor space, promising tens of billions of dollars to create their own fabrication places, to do R&D, to do all these kinds of stuff. And so we're going to see that as an area where I would argue it's really policies that have changed those supply chains and made them much bumpier than they would be then COVID.
So Bob, let me ask you a question, since I hear from Shannon, things are transitory, which I think translates into it's going to take a while to work out. What do we know about the therapeutics that are coming onto the market? I believe Merck had a drug which seemed to have some success in mitigating the consequences of COVID. Pfizer has come up with another therapeutic that may be even more successful, but this is before the new variant came about. Is there any sense that we might be entering a phase in which, through a combination of the vaccines and therapeutics, this could go from being a global disruptive event to something more, dare I say it, ordinary?
Yeah, I think, Jim, certainly before Omicron was reported, that was definitely the sense. And I still think there's a bit of guarded optimism out there as well. The antiviral medicines that you're mentioning from Merck and Pfizer in particular, these are oral. First of all, you're not getting a shot in the arm. You're taking these, and the results are pretty promising under the trials. Now, sometimes the first reporting you see on these are coming from the companies themselves. But there has been now several weeks of kind of reviews, and whether peer reviews or other types of reporting. And they do seem like they could make a serious effort at mitigating the impact of the virus. But part of this gets to the sense I was talking to about sort of public rules of the road in communities, not only in this country, but across the world in terms of how that can be more effective. So in this country, it is just some sort of the availability of affordable and regularly accessible testing so that you can know early enough on so you can take this medicine. If it is formally approved, I think the FDA has given some preliminary approvals, but say they're out there, you still need the early kind of warning that you have COVID to take this medicine and so that it can then have its greatest effect. So you're going to need to see a wider spread availability of testing. It is still kind of mind-boggling that it is all across the board in this country, wherever you go. I think part of the issue, in addition to that, is finding a political center, a stronger political center in terms of enforcing just standard good public health practices and not sort of riling up some cultural wars over steps that some people might see as inconvenient, but ultimately effective. And just sort of some of that, I think, comes with something we didn't talk about yet, which is what's been known as the infodemic, what's been called the infodemic surrounding COVID. And just, you know, the regular access to reliable information that both, say, rural whites who tend to be in certain states that have low vaccination rates that are very wary of them, and urban minorities who also are wary of vaccines, that can kind of puncture through some of the walls that they have put up or through which they are receiving information and provide some sort of generally acceptable information. It was interesting, our colleague Tom Boyke had his Think Global Health website that he oversees had tapped into a survey on trust involving public trust involving information coming out about COVID. And it was pretty solid that worldwide scientists are among the experts people trust the most. So the group never dipped below 60% in various ways the survey was set up. And especially people trust the local healthcare workers that they deal with. So somehow finding a way in which information is disseminated reliably and systematically so that we can do things like provide vaccine services that are then used and with ample warnings about what happens if you don't. But also, you know, masking practices as well as testing capabilities and other things that will help us, you know, deal with this pandemic as long as it exists. And maybe it still gets snuffed out or fades in 2022, Jim. But maybe there's something else, behind it that's different, that requires further attention. And maybe it's even more lethal. You know, there's going to need to be some sort of way in which the world responds to this. I mean, it's a tortured analogy, but if we reacted to this like as we did to, you know, terrorism concerns after 9/11, you would have seen much more of a collective action and people just sort of dealing with even some of the overreaction because of the greater good of preventing the possibility of, you know, wide-scale death. And so I think we have to get back there. It's the sort of the insidious nature of the virus, of any pandemic, that it makes it harder to do that, Jim. But I do think it's something that's going to require all these different efforts from local up to federal level.
You're an optimist, Bob, because based on my reading of social media, we're not going to stem the infodemic, much of which is information that's just flatly wrong, and partly because people can make money off of it.
That's another one of the issues that came to light and really surfaced in 2021, Jim, was, you know, the algorithms used by Facebook or the way in other social media platforms try to keep people on their platforms by allowing all sorts of crazy information to flourish. And some of them had tried to police this, but they are not required to under law. So will societies then require, you know, mass platforms where information is disseminated to hew to some basic standards, or is it going to just continue to be kind of the jungle out there?
I learned a Danish saying this morning that was trust enters on foot and leaves on horseback. So I think that's where American politics is today.
Our thanks to the Danes.
Well, Jim, I want to take us on horseback back to the United States and the issue of democracy. This coming January marks 1 year since President Biden was inaugurated on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. Between China, climate, COVID-19, just to name a few, it has been quite a challenging first year on the job for the president and longtime public servant, Joe Biden. Both the domestic and foreign policy of Joe Biden has received mixed reviews. Can you weigh in, Jim, on your assessment of the first year in the Oval Office?
Well, Bob, it depends upon whether you're grading on a curve or not. As you pointed out, Joe Biden inherited a really tough inbox. We discussed a number of those challenges already, led by the global pandemic and a surprisingly large number of Americans refusing to get a vaccine that would limit their ability to become infected with COVID. At the same time, Joe Biden is the first American president trying to govern with the majority of the members of the opposing political party believing, against all available evidence, that he was not legitimately elected. Throw in the fact that his own political party is divided and the control of the two houses of Congress are held by Democrats by the slimmest of margin, and you begin to wonder how he can get much of anything done. So, I think mixed is a fair way to approach the first year of the Biden presidency. Now, of course, he came into office making clear that domestic policy, and particularly getting the pandemic under control, was job number one, that foreign policy would be important, but not his primary occupation coming out of the gate. Even with that, he took a number of steps early on. He returned the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement and the World Health Organization. He breathed a new life into this Quad arrangement with Australia, India, and Japan. He renewed New START, the arms control treaty with Russia, renewed it for 5 years. And he ended U.S. support for offensive military operations in Yemen. Oh, I should also do a shout out to his success in negotiating a global minimum tax with other leading economies, all of which are, I think, significant initiatives, and all of which moved the country away from the America First policies that Donald Trump had championed. And you can see in variety of polling efforts done that America's image abroad improved significantly. And I think, you know, you should also add in, and this is harder to measure, but I do think that President Biden has had a fair amount of success in getting America's traditional friends, partners, and allies to come closer to him and to the United States on the issue of taking a tougher line against a whole range of Chinese policies. But I think it's also worth emphasizing that there's been a lot less change in American foreign policy than meets the eye with the shift from Donald Trump to Joe Biden on issues like China and trade. The Biden policy differs from Trump more in tone than in substance. I think this is particularly concerning on the issue of trade because Trump's tariffs continue to hurt rather than help American workers. But the Biden team seems to treat trade as an issue it doesn't want to go anywhere near, preferring instead to talk generically about a foreign policy for the middle class, but not talking about how to make trade policy actually work for the United States. I think, you know, Biden clearly has shown a penchant for acting unilaterally, just like Donald Trump. He canceled the Keystone XL pipeline, withdrew from Afghanistan, supported waiving intellectual property rights for vaccines, and created AUKUS, the security pact with Britain and Australia, all without significant consultations with critical partners. And I would say there have been a fair number of errors that one wouldn't have necessarily expected from an administration that came into office touting its experience and promising to restore order and more professionalism to American foreign policy. President Biden was very slow to nominate people for ambassadorships and other critical posts in the foreign policy and national security space. The administration bungled, and I think that's a kind word, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. There was the botched rollout from the AUKUS deal. President Biden himself later called it clumsy. And the president was really slow to make vaccines available to India back when COVID surged in March of this year. And I think more generally, I would have expected the Biden administration to have taken this issue of vaccine diplomacy and made it a much higher priority, given the opportunity it presented to fulfill the Biden administration's foreign policy job one, which is to sort of push back on China and to show that American foreign policy is still effective and helpful to other countries around the world. Now, as we come to the close of 2021, I think we have to note that in some ways, Joe Biden is facing a foreign policy inbox that's more daunting than the one he inherited. We have growing Chinese assertiveness, especially toward Taiwan. We're dealing right now with the threat of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Iranian nuclear program has been growing in size and scope. It's widely believed that Iran is now less than 1 month away from acquiring the material needed to build a nuclear device. And Joe Biden has to tackle all of these things in year two of his administration, with his approval rating sinking at home and the odds growing every day that Republicans will take one or both houses of Congress in the 2022 midterm elections. So at the end of year one, Joe Biden is not operating in foreign policy from a position of strength.
Jim, I wonder what your thoughts are on holding, as he did most recently, a summit on democracy and human rights. Was, say, fortuitous or not, maybe it's premature, but given all those issues he's facing and the fact that, as many critics would point out, both within the U.S. and abroad, the U.S. itself is finding itself challenged democratically, is finding its own rankings and various international benchmarks slipping in alarming ways, that it is not a country that should be really spending capital on being a standard bearer for rights and democracy, given everything else on the plate? Or is that something that just has to happen in tandem?
Well, there's a lot there in the question, Bob, and let me take it apart. I would say, number one, no summit in and of itself is going to change the course of history. And I don't think the Biden people, in having this summit of democracies, thought that simply having 2 days of Zoom meetings was going to really change things. I think the big question, if this summit meeting is going to have any legs, is what comes after it. Now, I don't think it is going to by itself reverse the global erosion in democracy that we have seen. But I do think it has some potential to help, particularly in countries where leaders want to sort of move toward more democratic governance, because it can give them a framework to talk to elements of their government who are, let's say, hostile to being less repressive or providing more rights or holding elections to do so. Now, that probably describes a small number of the governments that were invited to this talk. And I do think, you know, that there, it is fair to challenge the administration or to point out the hypocrisy. Why is it that Pakistan gets to attend the meeting, but Singapore doesn't? And you can go through that whole list. That's almost inevitable in these sort of meetings. And I do think, obviously, the United States does hold a weaker hand given January 6th, given that we have people in the United States continuing to deny that Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential election. That clearly runs contrary to what the Democracy Summit is doing. We are not the best messenger, or maybe rephrase that. We're not as good a messenger for this as we used to be, precisely because people look and see our own democratic backsliding. And I do think that for Joe Biden, if he really wants to make his summit of democracies work with his efforts abroad to reinforce and reinvigorate democracy, he has to find a way to reinvigorate democracy here at home. And here I do think there has been a lot of criticism of President Biden from his fellow Democrats for not taking the threat to American democratic governance, internal threat, seriously enough. Now, again, I understand the math on Capitol Hill is not favorable. As I noted earlier, Democrats control both houses of Congress by almost the narrowest of margins. And so it's hard to get legislation passed. But clearly, democracy here in the United States is in deep trouble. And I'm concerned about the 2022 midterm elections and how they're going to play out. And obviously, even further in the future, the 2024 presidential election. It is never healthy for democracy if people believe that the election itself is illegitimate, rigged, or compromised. That does not take you to a good place.
Jim, let me ask you a little bit about historical precedents of presidents in the latter part of their term switching from a domestic focus to a foreign policy focus. And I think that, you know, the Biden folks would tell you that we really came in to fix a lot of domestic stuff. And they would argue that they have been successful, even with a razor-thin margin in Congress, right? They would say we passed a stimulus bill in the first month or so in office. We then passed an infrastructure bill, $1.7 trillion of infrastructure that's going into law. They're working on this Build Back Better bill, which, you know, fits and starts and torturous path, but may get there before the midterms next year. They'd argue that they've created jobs and, you know, they're not back to pre-COVID levels, but they're getting there. So they've really focused on domestic side. Now, as you rightly point out, and history suggests, they will lose one or both houses in the next midterms for lots of reasons. And I would be interested in, as you look back at presidents in the past, if you started off with this big domestic focus, how successful were they if they then chose to turn to foreign policy out of necessity because things happened in the world, or perhaps because they were stymied at home because they're paralyzed by a Congress that wouldn't work with them on the domestic front?
I don't mean to suggest in any of my comments, Shannon, that Joe Biden didn't do anything on domestic policy. he clearly did. Now, you can have a discussion and arguing about whether those were the right things to do. There are many people who would argue and did argue before the original stimulus or relief package was passed that it would be inflationary, and worse than being inflationary, it would crowd out the ability of Joe Biden down the road to enact the kind of legislation he needed to make bigger structural changes to the U.S. economy and society and social safety net that the Biden people hope the Build Back Better plan may bring about. But again, we've been talking about the Build Back Better plan for months. And I think, you know, it's always nice to say, hey, you know, we're going to sort of compartmentalize what we do in our policy making. We're going to do domestic policy first, and then we'll get around to foreign policy. The problem with that is that the world is not sitting around waiting for you to get to its business. The world goes around and does stuff. And again, I feel a great deal of sympathy for the people in the Biden administration dealing with foreign policy. Again, a very big inbox full of tough, messy challenges, things that no one is going to solve. You can best manage to hopefully mitigate and make less pressing. So I want to begin with that as an opening thing. But I do think that the administration was slow, is slow to handle a number of foreign policy challenges. I would say particularly in dealing with issues related to trade. As you know, Shannon, from your own work, people aren't going to sit around forever waiting for the United States to develop a trade policy that is going to work. They're going to go off and cut their own trade deals. And that's going to redound to the long-term disadvantages of Americans and to American workers. Yes, are there things to dislike in past American trade agreements? Most certainly are. But the answer is simply not to say we can do without trade deals. And I think the Biden administration has been remiss on that. I think in terms of the question you're getting to is, well, if you can't get stuff done on domestic policy, should we go do foreign policy? Challenge you're going to find there is that, yes, some things you can do in foreign policy without Congress, or you can do until Congress has told you not to, and it's hard for Congress to act as a unitary institution. The problem that you're going to run into is that what you can't get done in domestic policy could really complicate what you're trying to do in foreign policy. I think a lot of countries working with the United States right now are having a conversation they didn't anticipate having this time last year. And it is, can Joe Biden sustain any of what he's promising to do or that he has already done? Or should we resign ourselves that come January 2025, either Donald Trump or somebody like Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States, America first will return with a vengeance. All the promises that the Biden administration made and all the talk about America's back is going to go by the wayside. And where will we be then? Now, again, if you start playing that conversation back in your head, what do governments start to do? They start to hedge. They don't want to put all their eggs in this basket. They start to do other things. We see some signs of this in the Middle East where, you know, there were rumors that the United Arab Emirates was sort of letting a clandestine Chinese military base be developed, so on and so forth. And you see it in the French reaction to the AUKUS deal, trying to, again, beat their drum about strategic autonomy. Europe has to be able to act independently of and at times against what it is the United States wishes to do. So all these things sort of fit together. You know, the knee bone is connected to the hip bone, is connected to the backbone. You can't simply say, well, there's domestic policy over here and then there's foreign policy over there. But you already know that.
Always good to be reminded.
And that wraps up The World Next Year. To all of our regular listeners, we hope you enjoyed this special episode of the podcast and that you'll tune in on Thursday, January 6th for our regular look at the world next week. Shannon, thanks so much for forecasting with us.
Always a pleasure to join you.
My thanks as well, Shannon.
Before we wrap this podcast, we want to tell you about another one dropping today. This is a new limited series podcast in which CFR President Richard Haass speaks with some of the most influential speakers of our time to explore 9 transformative issues that will shape the next century. It is called 9 Questions for the World.
Some of the topics discussed in 9 Questions for the World align with what we discussed today. Richard Haass sat down with Anne Applebaum, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, about the future of democracy. Richard also spoke with Michelle McMurray-Heath, president and CEO at the Biotechnology Innovation Organization, about the promises and perils of biotechnical research. And Richard sat down with Fareed Zakaria, Washington Post contributor and host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS, to discuss world order and the U.S. role as a global leader.
So be sure to subscribe to the podcast 9 Questions for the World on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Zoe had a very busy 2021 on the podcast side of things. Thank you as always, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, Chloe Mauvais, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and have a happy, healthy new year.